And after you've marked Psalm number 179, would you turn to Revelation 13? We'll certainly be devoting the entirety of our time to that chapter here in just a few minutes. Revelation, the 13th chapter. And as I bring you to that point, tonight's lesson will follow a pattern somewhat like those that have preceded it. As you can still well tell, though, by the title, our focus, in fact, many elements of our primary consideration will surround two beasts which are not only presented to us in this chapter, but that they are described in a way that our goal shall be to identify them and to draw some lessons of a practical character about them. Certainly, as you come to that introductory slide, could I point out again that we continue in the last book of the Bible, in a book that quite frankly fits under the heading of that apocalyptic section. And again, that word apocalyptic reminds us of the structure in which that truth is presented. It's presented in signs. It's presented by presentations. It's not just a narrative in chronological order. In fact, you probably would easily recognize that this kind of literature finds the greatest advantage in times of intense persecution and in times of direct hardship. Because you see, in those particular times, truth can be presented to those who can receive it, but that the persecutors will not understand that which is being shared. And that, quite frankly, was no doubt the case here as well. And so as we close that particular slide and come to chapter number 13, I think it's rather critical to devote at least a few moments to a matter of preparation, because I fear without that preparation we will lose sight of the basis and lose sight of the great lessons that are to be taken from chapter 13. And so for a few moments, I'm going to ask you to be reminded of what we learned in chapter 12. This builds and completes the story started in chapter 12. And so to quickly remind ourselves, in chapter 12 we saw a woman who was pregnant. She was about to in fact deliver the baby. But there was a dragon waiting to consume the baby as soon as the delivery took place. Furthermore, we noticed as the chapter proceeded, our goal was to identify the baby, identify the woman, identify the dragon, and we also learned several features about those identifications. The baby represented Christ. And we noticed, in the sense that the dragon attempted to devour the baby, it was the goal of the dragon, and we learned that to be the devil. It was his goal, you see, to take out the Christ, and he tried to kill him even while he was a baby. But of course he failed. He did not succeed at that. And so we notice he tried to kill the baby, but he failed. Satan's first failure, at least in that chapter. Then, after that failure, you may remember, he turned an element of persecution. As you can see on the slide, there was war in heaven. He sought to at least rebel against the character of the plan of God in heaven. But of course he failed at that too. You may recall that Michael and the angels with him cast out that old dragon, and thus he was defeated for a second time. Then came a third time. You notice now, upon the first two defeats, he turned his attention to the woman. He sought to persecute and, in fact, bring affliction upon her, but he failed one more time. Because you may recall that heaven allowed a matter of protection in regard to the woman, and in so doing, you may recall, for that period of some 42 months, she was preserved and provided for. Three times Satan tried and three times he failed. But the chapter ended in the last verse by at least describing a fourth attempt. So may I read verse 17 of chapter 12, which again reads like this. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So, he now turns his attention, having failed in light of the baby, having failed in light of the plan of God in heaven, and failed in light of the plan of God on earth, he now turns his attention to the seed of the woman. And the chapter ends. We are not told whether he was successful or not. We are not told the particulars of that attack. All we're told in that verse is that he mounts attacks against the remnant of the seed of the woman. And the question that no doubt comes to your mind and mine, what tactics did he use and was he successful? Chapter 13. That sets the stage then for our efforts of the night. What tactics did he use? And what agencies did he employ to bring about this attack against the remnant of the seed of the woman? And chapter 13 gives us the answers. It is, with that said, we close that particular slide and note this. You and I learned in passing last time that the remnant of the seed of the woman were those Christians. Those, as the verse in fact describes it, that keep the commandments of God, that have the testimony of Jesus Christ, those early saints, those early Christians. Now, certainly by continuation through the ages, you and I would hope to be numbered among that as well, but the first identification would be to them. And so the observation would be this. Wouldn't you agree that in light of Satan's earlier failures in regard to the baby, to the plan of God in heaven, to the plan of God on earth, he still could be seen as victorious if he could have killed every Christian on earth? Because if he ever were to succeed at that, then the next generation would not be able to as easily take place. Also, you might imagine, what if he could bring about a set of circumstances to drive the Christians away from their faith, to cause them to deny their faith? Well, then again, he would have won a tremendously great victory in light of the fact that if Christians did that, then they would not be dedicated to the actual Word of the Lord, and thus the next generation again would be in position that the gospel would not be as powerfully represented. At that point, why don't we then open chapter 13? How is Satan going to make this attack? On the slide that's now before you, I'm going to invite you to notice as I start reading chapter 13. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of the heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And that reading of Revelation 13, verses 1 to 10, has brought before our mind a description, a beast. And I'll jump forward to a picture. We will quickly go back in just a moment to give some more detail to some of those intermediate slides. But here is an artist's rendition. You might particularly note several things in light of the terribleness of the sight of that beast as it's described. First, it rose out of the sea. That's what the text said in verse 1. Furthermore, you may take note, its paws were like that of a bear, its body like that of a leopard. Furthermore, you appreciate the variety of the heads and the horns. You see somewhat clearly about a ferocious-looking thing. Without doubt, this kind of picture is intended for the imagination to see as an enactment took place. You might well see a portrait of water and this beast rises out of it. And clearly, truth is to be presented to us in a way that's reminiscent of what you see in it. Let's quickly go back to that previous slide. And this slide that's now before you at least selects some of the descriptions that we've just read and highlights them in the following way. Could I first point out in verse number 1 that somewhat about the pronoun needs to be corrected. The King James Version uses the word I stood upon the sand. The Greek rendering is really far better with the word he. And that would mean that it refers to the dragon and not to John. Because the dragon is what was immediately represented by the thoroughness of that previous chapter in the way that it ended. So the dragon is the one that stands on the shore, if you please, and suddenly before him rises this beast out of the sea. In addition to that, you notice that several things immediately are presented. First, 7 heads and 10 crowns. And what you notice written upon the nature of those heads, verse 1 says, the name is blasphemy. And immediately you and I learn about the fact that this beast is opposed to the matters connected to God. That's what blasphemy is. It is rebellion by way of directness and deliberation against the features of God Himself. Beyond that, again, I might invite you to take note. There were elements likened to a leopard, elements likened to a bear, elements likened to a lion, and all of those certainly have matters that we shall use in a moment to help us in the identification of this beast. But beyond that, it is certainly significant to notice the way verse 2 closes. Where did this beast get its power? And the text does not leave us to wonder. It says in that particular passage that the dragon gave him, the him being the beast, his power and his seat and great authority. That is to say, that dragon that we learned in the last chapter, which again is the devil, it's the devil that provides to the sea beast his power. That's where he gets his strength and his authority. It is not of heaven, nor of God in any way. It emanates from the dragon, from the devil himself. And so on the slide, you now appreciate that we have a very interesting development in verse number 3. One of the heads was wounded, but that it was healed. And in so doing, do you take note with me that all the world wondered after the beast. Whatever it is this beast represents, it impacted many, many peoples who gave attention to, and in fact, an element of obeisance to this beast. Furthermore, it's somewhat highlighted there was given to him, verse 4, they worshipped the dragon, which again is the devil, and they also worshipped the beast. So in our effort to identify the beast, we shall appreciate that it can be and was an object of worship, an object of dedication. It was possible to give one's attention to the point that it could be regarded as a kind or element of worship. Finally, as you close that slide, something in verse 5 tells us about the time frame. It says, there was given to him, that's that sea beast, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given to him for how long? 42 months. That's the same interval in time we encountered in chapter 11 and saw again in chapter 12. So may I suggest we're speaking about, at this point, the same kind of matter that existed for that same period in time that we highlighted and appreciated back on those occasions. And that'll aid us in just a moment as we give more elaboration to this. Verse 6, this sea beast opened his mouth against God. Notice, he directly arrays himself against that which would be of God, morally, ethically, and otherwise. But that's not all. He blasphemes his name, verse 6, and his tabernacle, that is to say, the very essence of what is involved in public service to him, and furthermore, they that dwell in heaven. So saints who had died, saints who had moved on, and at this point were in the realms beyond, and were in those places with conviction with regard to service to God, even they were blasphemed by this sea beast. Verse number 7, it was given to him to make war with the saints. Make no mistake. This sea beast blasphemed God, and in light of those that were saints on earth, he opposed them, he persecuted them, he afflicted them, he oppressed them. The sea beast, verse number 7, not only opposed them, but overcame them. That means whatever this sea beast represents, he was actively able to bring about their demise. to kill them, to put them to death. And now to verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him. Again, a far-reaching consideration to the point where whose names are not written in the book of life. As often as you and I have been impressed with the thought of the book of life, we notice here that whatever this sea beast represents, it is such that a large class, a large number of people gave service to him or it, and the only ones that didn't were the ones whose names were in the book of life. Now that again ought to be a strong element of consideration about the specialness of having one's name in that book. And now you'll notice in verse 13 another rather magnificent statement. That lamb that's mentioned is of course Jesus the Christ. But it says he was slain from the foundation of the world. In other words, it was in the mind of God that it was going to be a necessary and a current matter for Jesus to die in the way that he did. And that had been planned, it had been anticipated in the mind of God even prior to the very foundations of the world being laid. That surely should highlight for us the marvel of God's planning, making ready for human salvation. Only two verses remain. Verse 9, those that have an ear ought to hear this and take heed to it. And finally, verse 10. You may notice in light of that 10th verse, I suppose it would be fair to quickly say that those who are given to the sword will certainly have to give their life in light of that same sword. And those who promote captivity will themselves find themselves in captivity. You see, what goes around will come around. Let the Bible teach that, both Old and New Testaments. And suddenly at that point, you close the first 10 verses, and this beast has been described, and surely each of us would wonder, who is it? Or what is it? Starting about the middle part of that slide, I would invite you to note a few observations that I think, placed together, will allow us to identify the beast and give some additional teaching about the grandeur and lessons that can be helpful to you and me. First of all, did you note with me that the sea beast has a close similarity to the dragon? Now, they're not one and the same, but you'll notice, look at again verse number 1. This sea beast had 7 heads and 10 horns. Back in Revelation 12, verse number 3, how many heads did the dragon have? 7. How many horns did the dragon have? 7. Both of them had 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, in addition to that, may I say that we've already highlighted this fact. The source of the beast's power was the dragon. The devil gave the sea beast the power that he had, the authority that he had. And so that means that this sea beast could not have existed prior to the nature of the dragon giving him this. In fact, you and I would anticipate then that the power also would cease at the time that the dragon himself would cease to give it. The next point on the slide would be this. Blasphemy. That was the name on the heads of this sea beast. And that again reminds us, as verse number 6 will remind us, that it was opposed absolutely to the things of God. Next observation. It would seem to me verse 2 aids us rather mightily. Elements of this sea beast were of a lion, a bear, and a leopard. And as you and I are knowledgeable of the Old Testament, that makes us think of Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, Daniel was blessed by God in light of a vision, a dream as it's also called. And in that vision, he saw 4 beasts rise up one after the other. And would you be surprised to find one of those beasts was like a leopard, one of them was like a lion, one of them was like a bear. And that's the same elements that we see here. Now surely that's indicative of something. As you and I revisit Daniel chapter 7, we are told rather carefully that each one of those beasts represented a kingdom of men. The first one happened to be Babylon. The second one happened to be the Medo-Persians. The third one happened to be Greece. But the fact is, they represented empires of men. May I offer you the thought? In light of the association of this place, may I suggest to you that this would seemingly put us to the point of concluding that this sea beast that we now are considering was a kingdom, because it had elements consisting of those that were kingdoms in light of Daniel's revelation of Daniel 7. I wonder what kingdom this might be. You'll notice as you close that slide, in Daniel 7, verses 17 and following, Daniel was given the interpretation of that dream. We know that it represented kingdoms because God said that it did. We are not left to guess about that. We also aren't left to guess about some of the things on this next slide. If we now make the conclusion that this sea beast was representative of a kingdom of men, which kingdom was it? What civilization was it to be? May I also suggest that in Daniel 7, verse 7, 10 horns are thus mentioned, and 10 horns are also highlighted here. I think all of that allows us only one final thought. If it is a kingdom, would you now note this? In Revelation 17, which is a few chapters forward from this, we are told some more things about the sea beast. I'm going to only select a few relatively significant matters out of that 17th chapter and use them at this place. We learn in Revelation 17 that that sea beast is such that the seven heads were seven mountains. So now we're looking for a kingdom centered on seven hills or seven mountains. Not only that, the seven kings that are also highlighted in connection to that are such that five of them had come and gone, one of them then was, and one of them was yet to be. Well, that means it had to be a kingdom founded on seven mountains that was in existence at the time the revelation was being written. Because again, one of the kings was then reigning. What was the worldwide empire that was reigning at the time that John composed the revelation? It was the Roman Empire. May I suggest to you, the sea beast is the Roman Empire. All the clues point us rather exclusively, it seems to me, in that direction. And furthermore, you'll notice that also is consistent with what we learned in the two previous chapters, that the duration due to the persecution in Rome upon Christians was to last that proverbial time of 1,260 days, which is a time, times, and half a time, which is the same as 42 months. And that same element in time reappears here. It might well be in that light that all we have left to do is to close that slide like this. Who then is able to overcome this beast? For you'll notice it says that all nations were thus to be subject, all except those whose name were in the Lamb's Book of Life. This, verse number 10 tells us, is the patience and the faith of who? The saints. Those blessed and wonderful first and second century Christians who found themselves so strongly persecuted by the Roman government, by the Roman authorities, by those who were prompted by Roman power, they were the ones initially described by this, and they were thus led to appreciate that same plea that was raised back in chapter 6. How long, O Lord, before the cause for which we died is vindicated? And God said, it'll be a little while longer. There are more that must in fact die like you did. And John is revealing to those early saints, there's some intense persecution coming because there's a sea beast, and that sea beast is of course the place in which you're dwelling and living, and it is not going to go smoothly in many ways. The fact of history would lead us to note this: Nero was a very antagonistic person to the cause that you and I would call Christianity. But after him followed two Caesars who, although they weren't friends of Christianity, they at least didn't persecute it the same way that Nero did. But following those two, there arose a leader whose name was Domitian. Intense, extremely opposed to Christianity. And during his reign, he in fact began the most awful, intense persecution, up to that time at least, that the church had ever faced. And he was not to be the last. John is letting those early saints recognize and appreciate the fact that this beast is going to be a critical element that is going to be relevant and that you must face. But of course, that's not the end of the chapter. That's only up to verse 10. It is at that time I might bring us again to appreciate that figure, that portrait or picture. But of course, beginning in verse number 11, I need to take up reading again. You may recall that we asked, what agencies will this dragon use to persecute the remnant of the seed of the woman? And one of them is going to be this sea beast. But it wasn't the only one. Let's see what else Satan would have at his disposal. Beginning in verse 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake like a dragon. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth, they that should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And I'll stop right there. And we will try to conclude the chapter in our next section, of course. It'll come a little later this evening. But as you and I reflect upon the land beast, look at some of the features that might be said about this beast as this particular slide sets that before us. You and I might suppose it was bad enough to see that sea beast, but the devil has yet another beast, another one that rises. Let's make a few comments about who this one was and some of the features characteristic of him first. Notice this one arose out of the earth, not the sea, unlike the first one. Second of all, in verse number 11, this beast had two horns, not that vastly large number we had seen earlier with regard to the sea beast. But now comes this interesting observation. This beast, verse number 11, had two horns like a lamb. You and I think of a lamb as sweet, gentle, ready to receive instruction and, in fact, to follow. Those who keep sheep would be quick to tell us you could lead a sheep about anywhere you want him to go. They're somewhat docile on many occasions. But notice how the verse ends. It's not merely that. It says, though the two horns are like a lamb, he spoke like a dragon. Now the dragon, of course, reminds us of that devil that we had seen back in chapter 12. At this point, would you be impressed with me that it seems as if, on the one hand, looking like a lamb but speaking like a dragon makes you think of false religion? Because a lamb is representative in so many places in the Bible. Didn't Jesus describe it like that in John chapter 10? He said, I'm the good shepherd, and my sheep follow me. Didn't the Lord say that? And thus, those who would be portrayed as followers of the Lord are described as sheep. And yet here we see this lamb, but speaking like a dragon. That should at the very least remind us of a religion that was counterfeit. It appeared one way, but really was something different. Let's go even further to the next verse, verse 12. This land beast, we are told, exercised all the power of the first beast. So the terror, the persecution, the affliction, the awful nature that went with the first beast, the second beast had the capability, in light of presenting what that verse says, exercising the same power. And then it goes on to say this, the sole focus and the sole effort of this land beast was to direct worship to the sea beast. Twice that's pointed out to us. Note verse 12, this land beast causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. And then later in our reading, verse 15, and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. The sole work of the land beast, according to the revelation of this book, was to direct worship to the sea beast. Now the sea beast, being the Roman Empire, we now notice we're looking for a particular entity or force that was connected to the Roman Empire and directed worship to some element of it. We'll have to ask in a moment what that might have been. Surely, as you continue on that slide that's before you, look, this land beast had the capability in verse 14 to deceive. And it had the capability in verse 14 to do rather special things in the sight of people, what they would claim to be miracles. I would lead you then at that point to say this. As you close that slide that's before you, I've caused you to notice some of the statements that are made about those miracles as the word is used, and about the way in which that deception would lead you to highlight in verses 16 and following, transactions in business. So holding that thought in mind, verse 16 then says, "And he," that's that land beast, "causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save that he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. You'll notice then that the efforts of this land beast in terms of offering worship or encouraging worship of the first beast were such that it also was connected to the ability to buy and sell in the marketplaces. To buy and sell in light of things needed for sustenance. You know that folks back then, those that lived in the cities, they didn't have gardens. The places where you bought your food were the marketplaces. And many excavations and archaeologists have found evidences for these marketplaces in ancient Ephesus and Rome and so many other places. I wonder what was involved in gaining entrance to those marketplaces. How would you get in the door, in essence? Well, we'll have to see that in just a minute. But for right now, why don't we transition that slide to this one and try to make a few observations about the land beast. First, who was it? What was it? We succeeded in identifying the sea beast. Let's try to do something similar in regard to the land beast. First, this beast arose after the sea beast, meaning it did not come into existence prior to the elements of the Roman Empire. And the strange thing is, we learn later in Revelation 17, it will meet its demise also when the first beast does. So it did not last longer than the first beast. Whatever this represented, it ended, you see, when the Roman Empire did, or at least its immediate reflections did. Not only that, the counterfeit nature of its religion, directing worship to the first beast, that should be highlighted. What kind of religious system, prompted by the nature of these descriptions, would be consistent with this, that offered worship to the Roman Empire? Surely in that light, could I invite you to note this, which you can see about two-thirds of the way down that slide. There seems to be but one principle matter of consideration. You and I know, not only from the Revelation, but from even our high school studies in regard to the ancient Roman Empire, we know the way that that worked. The Caesars were deified. That is to say, Caesar was to be worshipped. Caesar was to be highly regarded. Not only did you, in fact, give the matter of debate concerning that necessity, but the Caesars would have tabernacles or temples built to them, and they were scattered all over the Roman Empire. And to gain entrance to those marketplaces, you had to bow and worship that statue of the Caesar that was positioned at the entrance place. You can immediately see with me the kind of challenge that a Christian would face. A Christian couldn't bow before those busts of the Caesars, couldn't bow before one of those statues. You'd be offering your worship to that Caesar, and the Bible says you cannot worship anyone but God, Matthew 4, verse 10. But what immediately then was the challenge? We can easily see it. If you couldn't get into that marketplace, how are you going to get the food to feed your family? How are you going to get the necessary items to lead to sustenance for yourself and your wife and your children? those early Christians were in a very difficult spot. Will I be true to the Lord and not worship the Caesar and perhaps make my family in a very hard condition, perhaps even death? Or will I relinquish my faith, compromising it if you please? I'll bow before that bus, go in and get me something to eat. It was a life and death decision. That would have been a hard place to be in terms of what the world would see. And you notice the devil succeeded in many ways here. Secular history records that many, many Christians died because of this. They would not bow before that Roman statue. They wouldn't do it. And they were put to death. Aren't you and I reminded then, they would not worship that Roman Caesar. I've listed on the slide for you that it would appear then that that land beast was that system that prompted the worship of the Caesars. I've called it the cult of emperor worship. As you give that thought, notice how consistent that seems to be with many of these particular descriptions. As you close that slide, we have history again that records many Christians in large numbers were often killed in extreme ways because they would not worship the Caesar. Now, I frankly confess to you that when you think about the remnant of the seed of the woman, those first century saints and the second century saints, they found themselves in extremely difficult circumstances facing two beasts. First, the demands of the Roman Empire, which blasphemed God, and then a system of worship in which they were demanded to worship the Caesar. You can now imagine how hard it was for them. No wonder we read about chapter 2 that Antipas was killed. He was the faithful martyr of the church at Pergamos. As you transition with me to the next slide, you now arrive at the closing few verses, and I think since this is seemingly the first question that you're likely to receive in light of the book of Revelation, if you're just speaking with somebody, it's almost certain that the first thing about which they'll ask, what is the mark of the beast? What is 666? You may have had conversation with folks who've said, well, they'll never allow that number to be the number in their phone number. They'll petition the phone company to change it, for they will not have 666. And there are people who will never stay in a hotel room with a triplicate of sixes, one right next to the other. And there are those that, again, will not involve themselves in something that seemingly has 666, one right after the other. In recent years, this has come to even be a matter of great discussion in light of business transactions. You may have already heard, and may I read it again so that you can also appreciate it with me. Verse number 16. He causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And there are those thus who take that in a literal fashion and say, well, look, here's a circumstance in which we have the description of this mark of the beast will be something here or something right there on the right forehand. Some years ago, in fact, it hadn't been that long now, a number of businesses made the proposal that in order to make transactions more effective, you and I know we use credit cards a lot, that seemingly has the way things become. What if you could surgically have a chip inserted in your hand so that when the time comes to purchase something, you just swipe your hand in front of it and you don't have to worry about having a card? There were many at that time who immediately, in light of that discussion, said, oh no, that's the mark of the beast. And they, of course, were referring to verse 16 of Revelation 13. Now, you might also appreciate in that description, though, that we are told in verse 18 that this is the number of a man. It's the number, you see, of that consistency described the number of the beast. The mark of the beast. On that slide that's before you, I ask you to consider a few matters with me, one of which is this. The key to that mark of the beast, you'll notice in context, was to buy and sell. It was a thoroughfare that permitted transactions, and we've already stated somewhat about that in light of, again, that worship consistent with not being willing to worship the Roman Caesars. But that still maybe doesn't completely answer. What does it mean when it says it's the number of a man? The number of a man. Well, at this point, maybe you and I are somewhat removed from the first century people who first heard that. I suspect they would have known immediately who that was. You and I, being this number of centuries removed, it's not easily as clear to us, but I'll make at least an observation. You and I know that much can be said about numerology. And by that I simply mean that letters have numerical value. So, the letter A has a number value with it. The letter B has a number value with it. The letter C has a number value with it. And it's not just English. Greek letters. Letters in Hebrew. There's an understood appreciation that you might notice on the slide that follows this one. This shows you a picture of the dragon on the one hand, the land beast on another hand, and the sea beast all at the same time. They each look terrible. They each look ferocious. They each captivate our thinking. And yet, we have identified what each one of them is without too much difficulty, at least on the whole. But this next picture is a numerology picture. You'll notice that there is a particular letter of the Greek alphabet and the number of the value that goes with it. Now, you may notice up 1 to 9, it goes in order, but then once you get past 10, it jumps to 20 and 30 and so on. And once you pass 90, it goes to 100 and so on. So the point might well be then, you could take a particular word like Randy, my first name, and take the value of the letter R, and the value of the letter A, and the value of the letter N, and so on, and add all them up. And you would have some numerical value that attaches to my name. Now, for a person who was in Greek, you could do the same thing. But on the right, Hebrew also operated in a way not unlike that. So may I say, the same is true in Latin. Now, Latin, of course, was the language that was spoken primarily in the Roman Empire. Let me go back to that previous slide and ask you to note the following. You might recall that in school, you may have learned about the Roman numerals, how that these are well appreciated. That's just an example of those Roman letters that have a numerical value attached to them. M was 1,000, and D was 500, and C was 100, and so forth. So when it says this is the number of a man, there was an individual, there was perhaps a class of individuals. And if you took the descriptive recognition to them and added up the letters, you would have come to the number 666, 666. Now, exactly who that was, I do find it a bit interesting that if you take the word Latinos, which referred to the Latin characteristic, and add up the numerical values of L-A-T-E-I-N-O-S, you get 666. I'll just offer that. I do not know that that's the actual one under consideration. But what I do know is that it's the number of a man. And I strongly suspect that the first century saints who heard this knew exactly who that was. This side of that time, the best you and I can say is whatever force was described in that mark, it opposed their capability to buy and sell. That's what the text says. So it was a characteristic person who operated in that fashion and in that way and was forcibly opposed to that element of life. I suppose in that light, you and I then do not need to be concerned about the mark of the beast in that same way. If your phone number or mine happens to have 3 sixes in it, well, so be it. I would even offer to you the interesting thought that the telephone exchange in Lafayette, Tennessee is 666. I've often thought, those people don't seem to be overly motivated by this. Not only that, why don't we then conclude our lesson like this? In Revelation 13, we have seen the particular attacks which the devil was to muster against the remnant of the seed of the woman, and it was going to involve two forces. One of them identified as a sea beast, the Roman Empire. The other identified as a land beast, which was that particular system of the required worship of the Roman Caesars. You might take note, that died when the Roman Empire did, just like Revelation 17 will demand. But it's also true that through it all, those early saints were encouraged, this is what you must face, but you must be faithful. Remember when we studied back in Revelation chapters 7 and 8? There was a beautiful mark on the forehead of the saints. It stands opposed to this mark of the beast, because you and I learned we wanted to have that mark of God. And just as Ezekiel 9 had pointed out, it was a mark of provision and protection and security and safety. And that's what those early saints needed. Times were going to be hard. They were going to be very, very difficult. And they needed this kind of message to inform them to be faithful always unto death, in the words of Revelation 2:10, and the crown of life would be theirs. Surely the false religion that went with the encouragement of that land beast reminds us that this mark of the beast is not what many in our modern day would want us to believe it is. May I say that you and I too want to be faithful in every way and all the time. And tonight, as you examine yourself, and I do the same for me, I trust that if we find ourselves amiss from the truth of God, that we will rush to the Master's side. It's true, we don't have these kinds of forces against us today. We have a government that allows us to serve and worship as we might please. And there is no demand on our part to worship the president or some other monarch on earth. Surely those early saints had a very challenging set of situations. Ours isn't nearly so challenging. But doesn't that mean that if we can't even be faithful now, what would happen if there were some times like that? I suspect that there are many who may well think they'd be faithful, just like Jeremiah would say, when the kitchen gets too hot, they might well flee the kitchen. You and I need to be ready, always to be faithful. Tonight, let us offer the Lord's invitation. If there's someone in this assembly who would wish to make a public response to that invitation, we want to make that available. To become a Christian requires that you believe in the Lord, repent of your sins, confess His name, and be baptized. And if you have known that way of Christianity, but as of tonight are not faithful, come back to that first love. Eternity is worth it. Eternity is worth anything that this life might throw at us. You need to repent of any sins then that are separating you from the Lord. Make confession of them, and He is more than delighted to forgive. Tonight, if we could be of help, aid at this point, we would wish to do that. A song of encouragement has been chosen. If we could be of that assistance, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?